Serafina put the child down on the riverbank, seeing that it was in no danger from the spectres, and they retreated to the air again. The little band of travellers had halted for good now. The horses cropped the grass or shook their heads at flies. The children were howling or clutching one another and watching from a distance, and every adult had fallen still. Their eyes were open. Some were standing, though most had sat down, and a terrible stillness hung over them. As the last of the spectres drifted away, sated, Serafina flew down and alighted in front of a woman sitting on the grass, a strong, healthy-looking woman whose cheeks were red and whose fair hair was glossy.
Woman!
There was no response.
Can you hear me? Can you see me?
She shook her shoulder. With an immense effort, the woman looked up. She scarcely seemed to notice. Her eyes were vacant, and when Serafina pinched the skin of her forearm, she merely looked down slowly and then away again. The other witches were moving through the scattered wagons, looking at the victims in dismay. The children, meanwhile, were gathering on a little knoll some way off, staring at the witches and whispering together fearfully.
The horseman's watching,
said a witch. She pointed up to where the road led through a gap in the hills. The rider who'd fled had reined in his horse and turned around to look back, shading his eyes to see what was going on.
We'll speak to him,
said Serafina, and sprang into the air. However the man had behaved when faced with the spectres, he was no coward. As he saw the witches approach, he unslung the rifle from his back and kicked the horse forward onto the grass, where he could wheel and fire and face them in the open. But Serafina Pekkala alighted slowly and held her bow out before laying it on the ground in front of her. Whether or not they had that gesture here, its meaning was unmistakable. The man lowered the rifle from his shoulder and waited, looking from Serafina to the other witches, and up to their demons, too, who circled in the skies above. Women, young and ferocious, dressed in scraps of black silk and riding pine branches through the sky? There was nothing like that in his world, but he faced them with calm wariness. Serafina, coming closer, saw sorrow in his face as well, and strength. It was hard to reconcile with the memory of his turning tail and running while his companions perished.
Who are you?
My name is Serafina Pekkala. I am the queen of the witches of Lake Anara, which is in another world. What is your name?
Joachim Lorenz. Witches, you say? Do you treat with the devil, then?
If we did, would that make us your enemy?
He thought for a few moments and settled his rifle across his thighs.
It might have done once, but times have changed. Why have you come to this world?
Because the times have changed. What are those creatures who attacked your party?
Well, the spectres,
he said, shrugging, half astonished.
Don't you know the spectres?
We've never seen them in our world. We saw you making your escape and we didn't know what to think. Now I understand.
There's no defense against them. Only the children are untouched. Every party of travelers has to include a man and a woman on horseback by law. And they have to do what we did, or else the children will have no one to look after them. But times are bad now. The cities are thronged with specters. And there used to be no more than a dozen or so in each place.
Ruta Skadi was looking around. She noticed the other rider moving back towards the wagons and saw that it was indeed a woman. The children were running to meet her.
But tell me what you're looking for. You didn't answer me before. You wouldn't have come here for nothing. Answer me now.
We're looking for a child, a young girl from our world. Her name is Lyra Belacqua, called Lyra Silvertongue. But where she might be in a whole world we can't guess. You haven't seen a strange child on her own.
No, but we saw angels the other night, making for the pole.
Angels?
Troops of them in the air, armed and shining. They haven't been so common in the last years. Though in my grandfather's time they passed through this world often, or so he used to say.
He shaded his eyes and gazed down toward the scattered wagons, the halted travellers. The other rider had dismounted now and was comforting some of the children. Serafina followed his gaze and said,
If we camp with you tonight and keep guard against the spectres, will you tell us more about this world and these angels you saw?
Certainly I will. Come with me.
The witches helped to move the wagons farther along the road, over the bridge and away from the trees where the spectres had come from. The stricken adults had to stay where they were, though it was painful to see the little children clinging to a mother who no longer responded to them, or tugging the sleeve of a father who said nothing and gazed into nothing and had nothing in his eyes. The younger children couldn't understand why they had to leave their parents. The older ones, some of whom had already lost parents of their own and who had seen it before, simply looked bleak and stayed dumb. Serafina picked up the little boy who'd fallen in the river and who was crying out for his daddy, reaching back over Serafina's shoulder to the silent figure still standing in the water, indifferent. Serafina felt his tears on her bare skin. The horsewoman, who wore rough canvas breeches and rode like a man, said nothing to the witches. Her face was grim. She moved the children on, speaking sternly, ignoring their tears. The evening sun suffused the air with a golden light in which every detail was clear and nothing was dazzling, and the faces of the children and the man and woman, too, seemed immortal and strong and beautiful. Later, as the embers of a fire glowed in a circle of ashy rocks and the great hills lay calm under the moon, Joachim Lorenz told Serafina and Rutaskadi about the history of his world. It had once been a happy one, he explained. The cities were spacious and elegant, the fields well-tilled and fertile. Merchant ships plied to and fro on the blue oceans, and fishermen hauled in brimming nets of cod and tunny, bass and mullet. The forests ran with game, and no children went hungry. In the courts and squares of the great cities, ambassadors from Brazil and Benin, from Ireland and Korea, mingled with tobacco sellers, with commedia players from Bergamo, with dealers in fortune bonds. At night, masked lovers met under the rose-hung colonnades or in the lamplit gardens, and the air stirred with the scent of jasmine and throbbed to the music of the wire-strung mandarone. The witches listened wide-eyed to this tale of a world so like theirs, and yet so different.
But it went wrong. 300 years ago, it all went wrong. Some people reckon the Philosophers' Guild of the Torre degli Angeli, the Tower of the Angels, in the city we have just left, they're the ones to blame. Others say it was a judgment on us for some great sin, though I never heard any agreement about what that sin was. But suddenly, out of nowhere, there came the specters, and we've been haunted ever since. You've seen what they do. Now, imagine what it is to live in a world with specters in it. How can we prosper when we can't rely on anything continuing as it is? At any moment, a father might be taken, or a mother, and the family fall apart. A merchant might be taken, and his enterprise fail, and all his clerks and factors lose their employment. And how can lovers trust their vows? All the trust and all the virtue fell out of our world when the specters came.
Who are these philosophers, and where is this tower you speak of?
In the city we left, Citagazze, the city of magpies. You know why it's called that? Because magpies steal, and that's all we can do now. We create nothing. We have built nothing. For hundreds of years, all we can do is steal from other worlds. Oh, yes, we know about other worlds. Those philosophers in the Torre degli Angeli discovered all we need to know about that subject. They have a spell, which, if you say it, lets you walk through a door that isn't there and find yourself in another world. Some say it's not a spell, but a key that can open even where there isn't a lock. Who knows? Whatever it is, it let the specters in. And the philosophers use it still, I understand. They pass into other worlds and steal from them and bring back what they find. Gold and jewels, of course, but other things, too, like ideas, or sacks of corn, or pencils, they are the source of all our wealth, that guild of thieves.
Why don't the specters harm children?
Asked Rutaskadi.
That is the greatest mystery of all. In the innocence of children, there's some power that repels the specters of indifference. But it's more than that. Children simply don't see them, though we can't understand why. We never have. But specter orphans are common. As you can imagine, children whose parents have been taken, they gather in bands and roam the country, and sometimes they hire themselves out to adults to look for food and supplies in a spectre-ridden area, and sometimes they simply drift about and scavenge. So, that is our world. Or we manage to live with this curse. They're true parasites. They won't kill their host, though they drain most of their life out of him. But there was a rough balance. Till recently. Till the great storm. Such a storm it was. It sounded as if the whole world was breaking and cracking apart. There hadn't been a storm like that in memory. And then there came a fog that lasted for days and covered every part of the world that I know of, and no one could travel. And when the fog cleared, the cities were full of the specters, hundreds and thousands of them. So we fled to the hills and out to sea. But there's no escaping them this time, wherever we go, as you saw for yourselves. Now it's your turn. You tell me about your world, and why you have left it to come to this one.
Serafina told him truthfully as much as she knew. He was an honest man, and there was nothing that needed concealing from him. He listened closely, shaking his head with wonder, and when she had finished, he said,
I told you about the power they say our philosophers have of opening the way to other worlds. Well, some think that occasionally they leave a doorway open out of forgetfulness. I wouldn't be surprised if travelers from other worlds found their way here from time to time. We know that angels pass through, after all.
Angels? You mentioned them before. They are new to us. Can you explain them?
You want to know about angels? Very well. Their name for themselves is Bene Elim, I'm told. Some call them watchers, too. They're not beings of flesh like us. They are beings of spirit. Or maybe their flesh is more finely drawn than ours, lighter and clearer. I wouldn't know. But they're not like us. They carry messages from heaven. That's their calling. We see them sometimes in the sky, passing through this world on the way to another, shining like fireflies, way, way up high. On a still night you can even hear their wing beats. They have concerns different from ours, though in the ancient days they came down and had dealings with men and women. And they bred with us too, some say. And when the fog came, after the great storm, I was beset by specters in the hills behind the city of Santalia, on my way homeward. I took refuge in a shepherd's hut by a spring next to a birch wood, and all night long I heard voices above me in the fog. Cries of alarm and anger, and wing beats, too, closer than I had ever heard them before. And towards dawn, there was the sound of a skirmish of arms, the whoosh of arrows, and the clang of swords. I daren't go out and see, though I was powerfully curious, for I was afraid. I was stark terrified, if you want to know. When the sky was as light as it ever got during that fog, I ventured to look out, and I saw a great figure lying wounded by the spring. I felt as if I was seeing things I had no right to see. Sacred things. I had to look away. And when I looked again, the figure was gone. That's the closest I ever came to an angel. But, as I told you, we saw them the other night, way high aloft among the stars, making for the pole like a fleet of mighty ships under sail. Something is happening, and we don't know down here what it may be. There could be a war breaking out. There was a war in heaven once, oh, thousands of years ago, immense ages back, but I don't know what the outcome was. It wouldn't be impossible if there was another. But the devastation would be enormous, and the consequences for us, I can't imagine it. Though,
he went on, sitting up to stir the fire,
the end of it might be better than I fear. It might be that a war in heaven would sweep the specters from this world altogether, and back into the pit they come from. What a blessing that would be, eh? How fresh and happy we could live, free of that fearful blight.
Though Joachim Lorenz looked anything but hopeful as he stared into the flames. The flickering light played over his face, but there was no play of expression in his strong features. He looked grim and sad. Ruta Skadi said,
The pole, sir. You said these angels were making for the pole. Why would they do that, do you know? Is that where heaven lies?
I couldn't say. I'm not a learned man. You can see that plain enough. But the north of our world, well, that's the abode of spirits, they say. If angels were mustering, that's where they'd go. And if they were going to make an assault on heaven, I dare say that's where they'd build their fortress and sally out from.
He looked up, and the witches followed his eyes. The stars in this world were the same as theirs. The Milky Way blazed bright across the dome of the sky, and innumerable points of starlight dusted the dark, almost matching the moon for brightness.
Sir, did you ever hear of dust?
Dust? I guess you mean it in some other sense than the dust on the roads. No, I never did. But look, there's a troop of angels now!
He pointed to the constellation of Ophiuchus. And sure enough, something was moving through it, a tiny cluster of lighted beings. And they didn't drift. They moved with a purposeful flight of geese or swans. Rutascardi stood up.
Sister, it's time I parted from you. I'm going up to speak to these angels, whatever they may be. If they're going to Lord Asriel, I'll go with them. If not, I'll search on by myself. Thank you for your company, and go well.
They kissed, and Rutascardi took her cloud pine branch and sprang into the air. Her demon, Sergi, a blue-throat, sped out of the dark alongside her.
We're going high?
As high as those lighted flyers in Ophiuchus. They're going swiftly, Sergi. Let's catch them!
And she and her demon raced upward, flying quicker than sparks from a fire, the air rushing through the twigs on her branch and making her black hair stream out behind. She didn't look back at the little fire and the wide darkness, at the sleeping children and her witch companions. That part of her journey was over, and besides, those glowing creatures ahead of her were no larger yet, and unless she kept her eye on them, they were easily lost against the great expanse of starlight. So she flew on, never losing sight of the angels, and gradually, as she came closer, they took on a clearer shape. They shone, not as if they were burning, but as if, wherever they were and however dark the night, sunlight was shining on them. They were like humans, but winged, and much taller, and as they were naked, the witch could see that three of them were male, two female. Their wings sprang from their shoulder blades, and their backs and chests were deeply muscled. Rutascardi stayed behind them for some way, watching, measuring their strength in case she should need to fight them. They weren't armed, but on the other hand they were flying easily within their power and might even outstrip her if it came to a chase. Making her bow ready, just in case, she sped forward and flew alongside them, calling,
"Angels, halt and listen to me. I am the witch Rutascardi, and I want to talk to you."
They turned. Their great wings beat inward, slowing them, and their bodies swung downward till they were standing upright in the air, holding their position by the beating of their wings. They surrounded her, five huge forms glowing in the dark air, lit by an invisible sun. She looked around, sitting on her pine branch, proud and unafraid, though her heart was beating with the strangeness of it, and her demon fluttered to sit close to the warmth of her body. Each angel being was distinctly an individual, and yet they had more in common with one another than with any human she had seen. What they shared was a shimmering, darting play of intelligence and feeling that seemed to sweep over them all simultaneously. They were naked, but she felt naked in front of their glance. It was so piercing and went so deep. Still, she was unashamed of what she was, and she returned their gaze with head held high.
"So you are angels, or watchers, or Bene Elim. Where are you going?"
"We are following a call."
She was not sure which one had spoken. It might have been any or all of them at once.
"Whose call?"
"A man's."
"Lord Asriel's?"
"It may be."
"Why are you following his call?"
"Because we are willing to."
"Then wherever he is, you can guide me to him as well."
Rutascardi was 416 years old, with all the pride and knowledge of an adult witch queen. She was wiser by far than any short-lived human, but she had not the slightest idea of how like a child she seemed beside these ancient beings. Nor did she know how far their awareness spread out beyond her, like filamentary tentacles to the remotest corners of universes she had never dreamed of. Nor that she saw them as human-formed only because her eyes expected to. If she were to perceive their true form, they would seem more like architecture than organism, like huge structures composed of intelligence and feeling. But they expected nothing else, She was very young. At once they beat their wings and surged forward, and she darted with them, surfing on the turbulence their pinions caused in the air, and relishing the speed and power it added to her flight. They flew throughout the night. The stars wheeled around them, and faded and vanished as the dawn seeped up from the east. The world burst into brilliance as the sun's rim appeared, and then they were flying through blue sky and clear air, fresh and sweet and moist. In the daylight the angels were less visible, though to any eye their strangeness was clear. The light route Ascari saw them by was still not that of the sun now climbing the sky, but some other light from somewhere else. Tirelessly they flew on, and tirelessly she kept pace. She felt a fierce joy possessing her that she could command these immortal presences, and she rejoiced in her blood and flesh, in the rough pine bark she felt next to her skin, in the beat of her heart and the life of all her senses, and in the hunger she was feeling now, and in the presence of her sweet-voiced blue-throat demon, and in the earth below her and the lives of every creature, plant and animal both. And she delighted in being of the same substance as them, and in knowing that when she died her flesh would nourish other lives as they had nourished her. And she rejoiced, too, that she was going to see Lord Asriel again. Another night came, and still the angels flew on. And at some point the quality of the air changed, not for the worse or the better, but changed nonetheless, and Ruta Skadi knew that they'd passed out of that world and into another. How it had happened she couldn't guess.
"Angels!"
she called as she sensed the change.
"How have we left the world I found you in? Where was the boundary?"
"There are invisible places in the air, gateways into other worlds. We can see them, but you cannot."
Ruta Skadi couldn't see the invisible gateway, but she didn't need to. Witches could navigate better than birds. As soon as the angel spoke, she fixed her attention on three jagged peaks below her and memorized their configuration exactly. Now she could find it again if she needed to, despite what the angels might think. They flew on farther, and presently she heard an angel voice.
"Lord Asriel is in this world, and there is the fortress he's building."
They had slowed, and were circling like eagles in the middle airs. Ruta Skadi looked where one angel was pointing. The first faint glimmer of light was tinting the east, though all the stars above shone as brilliantly as ever against the profound velvet black of the high heavens. And on the very rim of the world, where the light was increasing moment by moment, a great mountain range reared its peaks, jagged spears of black rock, mighty broken slabs, and saw-tooth ridges piled in confusion like the wreckage of a universal catastrophe. But on the highest point, which as she looked was touched by the first rays of the morning sun and outlined in brilliance, stood a regular structure, a huge fortress whose battlements were formed of single slabs of basalt, half a hill in height, and whose extent was to be measured in flying time. Beneath this colossal fortress, fires glared and furnaces smoked in the darkness of early dawn, and from many miles away Ruta Skadi heard the clang of hammers and the pounding of great mills. And from every direction she could see more flights of angels winging toward it, and not only angels but machines too, steel-winged craft gliding like albatrosses, glass cabins under flickering dragonfly wings, droning zeppelins like huge bumblebees, all making for the fortress that Lord Asriel was building on the mountains at the edge of the world.
"And is Lord Asriel there?"
"Yes, he is there."
"Then let's fly there to meet him. And you must be my guard of honor."
Obediently they spread their wings and set their course toward the gold-rimmed fortress, with the eager witch flying before them. Chapter 7. The Rolls-Royce. Lyra woke early to find the morning quiet and warm, as if the city never had any other weather than this calm summer. She slipped out of bed and downstairs, and hearing some children's voices out on the water, went to see what they were doing. Three boys and a girl were splashing across the sunlit harbour in a couple of pedal boats, racing towards the steps. As they saw Lyra, they slowed for a moment, but then the race took hold of them again. The winners crashed into the steps so hard that one of them fell into the water, and then he tried to climb into the other craft and tipped that over too, and then they all splashed about together as if the fear of the night before had never happened. They were younger than most of the children by the tower, Lyra thought, and she joined them in the water, with Pantalaimon as a little silver fish glittering beside her. She never found it hard to talk to other children, and soon they were gathered around her, sitting in pools of water on the warm stone, their shirts drying quickly in the sun. Poor Pantalaimon had to creep into her pocket again, frog-shaped in the cool, damp cotton.
What are you going to do with that cat?
Can you really take the bad luck away?
Where you come from?
Your friend, he ain't afraid of spectres.
Will ain't afraid of anything, nor am I. What are you scared of cats for?
You don't know about cats. Cats, they got the devil in them, all right. You gotta kill every cat you see. They bite you and put the devil in you, too. And what was he doing with that big pard?
She realised he meant Pantalaimon in his leopard shape and shook her head innocently.
You must have been dreaming. There's all kinds of things look different in the moonlight. But me and Will, we don't have spectres where we come from, so we don't know much about them.
If you can't see them, you're safe. You see them, you know they can get you. That's what my pa said. Then they got him.
And they're here, all around us now.
Yeah,
said the girl. She reached out a hand and grabbed a fistful of air, crowing,
I got one now! They can't hurt you, so we can't hurt them, all right?
And there's always been spectres in this world.
Yeah. No, they came a long time ago. Hundreds of years.
They came because of the guild.
The what?
They never. My granny said they came because people were bad and God sent them to punish us.
Your granny don't know nothing. She got a beard, your granny. She's a goat, all right?
What's the guild?
You know the Torre degli Angeli? The stone tower, right? Well, it belongs to the guild and there's a secret place in there. The guild, they're men who know all kind of things. Philosophy, alchemy, all kind of things they know. And they were the ones who let the spectres in.
That ain't true. They come from the stars.
It is. This is what happened, all right? This guild man, hundreds of years ago, was taking some metal apart. Lead. He was going to make it into gold. And he cut it, smaller and smaller, till he came to the smallest piece he could get. There ain't nothing small in that. So small, you couldn't see it even. But he cut that too, and inside the smallest little bit, there was all the spectres packed in, twisted over and folded up so tight they took up no space at all. But once he cut it, bam! They washed out and they've been here ever since. That's what my papa said.
Is there any guild men in the tower now?
No, they run away like everyone else.
There ain't no one in the tower. That's haunted, that place. That's why the cat came from there. We ain't gonna go in there, all right? Ain't no kids gonna go in there. That's scary.
The guild men ain't afraid to go in there. They got special magic or something. They're greedy. They live off the poor people. The poor people do all the work, and the guild men just live there for nothing.
But there ain't anyone in the tower now. No grown-ups.
No grown-ups in the city at all.
They wouldn't dare, all right?
But she had seen a young man up there. She was convinced of it. And there was something in the way these children spoke. As a practiced liar, she knew liars when she met them, and they were lying about something. And suddenly she remembered. Little Paolo had mentioned that he and Angelica had an elder brother, Tullio, who was in the city too, and Angelica had hushed him. Could the young man she'd seen have been their brother? She left them to rescue their boats and paddle back to the beach, and went inside to make some coffee and see if Will was awake. But he was still asleep, with a cat curled up at his feet, and Lyra was impatient to see her scholar again. So she wrote a note and left it on the floor by his bedside, and took her rucksack and went off to look for the window. The way she took led her through the little square they'd come to the night before. But it was empty now, and the sunlight dusted the front of the ancient tower and showed up the blurred carvings beside the doorway. Human-like figures with folded wings, their features eroded by centuries of weather, but somehow in their stillness expressing power and compassion and intellectual force.
Angels,
said Pantalaimon, now a cricket on Lyra's shoulder.
Maybe spectres.
No, they said this was something angelly. Bet that's angels.
Shall we go in?
They looked up at the great oak door on its ornate black hinges. The half-dozen steps up to it were deeply worn, and the door itself stood slightly open. There was nothing to stop Lyra from going in except her own fear. She tiptoed to the top of the steps and looked through the opening. A dark stone-flagged hall was all she could see, and not much of that, but Pantalaimon was fluttering anxiously on her shoulder, just as he had when they'd played the trick on the skulls in the crypt at Jordan College, and she was a little wiser now. This was a bad place. She ran down the steps and out of the square, making for the bright sunlight of the Palm Tree Boulevard. And as soon as she was sure there was no one looking, she went straight across to the window and threw into Will's Oxford. 40 minutes later, she was inside the physics building once more, arguing with the porter. But this time she had a trump card.
You just asked Dr. Malone. That's all you got to do. Ask her. She'll tell you.
The porter turned to his telephone and Lyra watched pityingly as he pressed the buttons and spoke into it. They didn't even give him a proper lodge to sit in like a real Oxford college. Just a big wooden counter, as if it was a shop.
All right. She says go on up. Mind you don't go anywhere else.
No, I won't.
She said demurely, a good little girl doing what she was told. At the top of the stairs, though, she had a surprise, because just as she passed a door with a symbol indicating woman on it, it opened, and there was Dr. Malone silently beckoning her in. She entered, puzzled. This wasn't the laboratory, it was a washroom, and Dr. Malone was agitated.
Lyra! There's someone else in the lab, police officers or something. They know you came to see me yesterday. I don't know what they're after, but I don't like it.
What's going on? How do they know I came to see you?
I don't know. They didn't know your name, but I knew who they meant.
Oh, well, I can lie to them. That's easy.
But what is going on?
A woman's voice spoke from the corridor outside.
Dr. Malone, have you seen the child?
Yes. I was just showing her where the washroom is.
There was no need for her to be so anxious, thought Lyra, but perhaps she wasn't used to danger. The woman in the corridor was young and dressed very smartly, and she tried to smile when Lyra came out, but her eyes remained hard and suspicious.
Hello. You're Lyra, are you?
Yeah. What's your name?
I'm Sergeant Clifford. Come along in.
Lyra thought this young woman had a nerve, acting as if it were her own laboratory, but she nodded meekly. That was the moment when she first felt a twinge of regret. She knew she shouldn't be here. She knew what the alethiometer wanted her to do, and it was not this. She stood doubtfully in the doorway. In the room already there was a tall, powerful man with white eyebrows. Lyra knew what scholars looked like, and neither of these two was a scholar.
Come in, Lyra. It's all right. This is Inspector Walters.
Hello, Lyra. I've been hearing all about you from Dr. Malone here. I'd like to ask you a few questions, if that's all right.
What sort of questions?
Nothing difficult. Come and sit down, Lyra.
He pushed a chair towards her. Lyra sat down carefully and heard the door close itself. Dr. Malone was standing nearby. Pantalaimon, cricket-formed in Lyra's breast pocket, was agitated. She could feel him against her breast and hoped the tremor didn't show. She thought to him to keep still.
Where'd you come from, Lyra?
If she said Oxford, they'd easily be able to check. But she couldn't say another world, either. These people were dangerous. They'd want to know more at once. She thought of the only other name she knew of in this world, the place Will had come from.
Winchester.
You've been in the wars, haven't you, Lyra? How did you get those bruises? There's a bruise on your cheek and another on your leg. Has someone been knocking you about?
No.
Do you go to school, Lyra?
Yeah, sometimes.
Well, shouldn't you be at school today?
She said nothing. She was feeling more and more uneasy. She looked at Dr. Malone, whose face was tight and unhappy.
I just came here to see Dr. Malone.
Are you staying in Oxford, Lyra? Where are you staying?
With some people. Just friends.
What's their address?
I don't know exactly what it's called. I can find it easy, but I can't remember the name of the street.
Well, who are these people?
Just friends of my father.
Oh, I see. How did you find Dr. Malone?
'Cause my father's a physicist, and he knows her.
It was going more easily now, she thought. She began to relax into it and lie more fluently.
And she showed you what she was working on, did she?
Yeah, the engine with the screen. Yes, all that.
You're interested in that sort of thing, are you? Science and so on?
Yeah, physics especially.
You're going to be a scientist when you grow up?
That sort of question deserved a blank stare, which it got. He wasn't disconcerted. His pale eyes looked briefly at the young woman and then back to Lyra.
And were you surprised at what Dr. Malone showed you?
Well, sort of, but I knew what to expect.
Because of your father?
Yeah, because he's doing the same kind of work.
Yes, quite. Do you understand it?
Some of it.
Your father's looking into dark matter, then?
Yes.
Has he got as far as Dr. Malone?
Not in the same way. He can do some things better, but that engine with the words on the screen, he hasn't got one of those.
Is Will staying with your friends as well?
Yes, he...
And she stopped. She knew at once she'd made a horrible mistake. So did they, and they were on their feet in a moment to stop her from running out, but somehow Dr. Malone was in the way and the sergeant tripped and fell, blocking the way of the inspector. It gave Lyra time to dart out, slam the door shut behind her, and run full tilt for the stairs. Two men in white coats came out of a door and she bumped into them. Suddenly Pantalaimon was a crow, shrieking and flapping. and he startled them so much they fell back, and she pulled free of their hands and raced down the last flight of stairs into the lobby, just as the porter put the phone down and lumbered along behind his counter, calling out,
"Oi! Stop there, you!"
But the flap he had to lift was at the other end, and she got to the revolving door before he could come out and catch her. And behind her, the lift doors were opening, and the pale-haired man was running out, so fast, so strong. And the door wouldn't turn. Pantalaimon shrieked at her. They were pushing the wrong side. She cried out in fear and turned herself around, hurling her little weight against the heavy glass, willing it to turn, and got it to move just in time to avoid the grasp of the porter, who then got in the way of the pale-haired man, so Lyra could dash out and away before they got through. Across the road, ignoring the cars, the brakes, the squeal of tyres, into this gap between tall buildings, and then another road with cars from both directions. But she was quick, dodging bicycles, always with the pale-haired man just behind her. Oh, he was frightening. Into a garden, over a fence, through some bushes, Pantalaimon skimming overhead, a swift, calling to her which way to go, crouching down behind a coal bunker as the pale man's footsteps came racing past, and she couldn't hear him panting, he was so fast and so fit. And Pantalaimon said,
"Back now! Go back to the road!"
So she crept out of her hiding place and ran back across the grass, out through the garden gate, into the open spaces of the Banbury Road again. And once again she dodged across, and once again tyres squealed on the road. And then she was running up Norham Gardens, a quiet, tree-lined road of tall Victorian houses near the park. She stopped to gain her breath. There was a tall hedge in front of one of the gardens with a low wall at its foot, and she sat there tucked closely in under the privet.
"She helped us. Dr. Malone got in their way. She's on our side, not theirs."
"Oh, Pan, I shouldn't have said that about Will. I should have been more careful."
"Shouldn't have come."
"I know, that too."
But she hadn't got time to berate herself because Pantalaimon fluttered to her shoulder and then said,
"Look out! Behind!"
And immediately changed to a cricket again and dived into her pocket. She stood, ready to run, and saw a large dark blue car gliding silently to the pavement beside her. She was braced to dart in either direction, but the car's rear window rolled down, and there, looking out, was a face she recognised.
"Lizzie,"
said the old man from the museum.
"How nice to see you again. Can I give you a lift anywhere?"
And he opened the door and moved up to make room beside him. Pantalaimon nipped her breast through the thin cotton, but she got in at once, clutching the rucksack, and the man leaned across her and pulled the door shut.
"You look as if you're in a hurry. Where do you want to go?"
"Up Summertown, please."
The driver was wearing a peaked cap. Everything about the car was smooth and soft and powerful, and the smell of the old man's cologne was strong in the enclosed space. The car pulled out from the pavement and moved away with no noise at all.
"So, what have you been up to, Lizzie? Did you find out more about those skulls?"
"Yeah,"
she said, twisting to see out of the rear window. There was no sign of the pale-haired man. She'd got away, and he'd never find her now she was safe in a powerful car with a rich man like this. She felt a little hiccup of triumph.
"I made some inquiries, too. An anthropologist friend of mine tells me that they've got several others in the collection, as well as the ones on display. Some of them are very old indeed. Neanderthal, you know."
"Yeah, that's what I heard, too,"
Lyra said, with no idea what he was talking about.
"And how's your friend?"
"What friend?"
said Lyra, alarmed. Had she told him about Will, too?
"The friend you're staying with."
"Oh, yes, she's very well, thank you."
"What does she do? Is she an archaeologist?"
"Oh, she's a physicist. She studies dark matter,"
said Lyra, still not quite in control. In this world it was harder to tell lies than she'd thought. And something else was nagging at her. This old man was familiar in some long-lost way, and she just couldn't place it.
"Dark matter? How fascinating. I saw something about that in the Times this morning. The universe is full of this mysterious stuff, and nobody knows what it is. And your friend is on the track of it, is she?"
"Yes, she knows a lot about it."
"And what are you going to do later on, Lizzie? Are you going in for physics too?"
"I might. It depends."
The chauffeur coughed gently and slowed the car down.
"Well, here we are in Summertown. Where would you like to be dropped?"
"Oh, just up past these shops. I can walk from there. Thank you."
Turn left into South Parade and pull up on the right, could you, Alan?"
"Very good, sir."
A minute later, the car came to a silent halt outside a public library. The old man held open the door on his side so that Lyra had to climb past his knees to get out. There was a lot of space, but somehow it was awkward, and she didn't want to touch him, nice as he was.
"Don't forget your rucksack,"
he said, handing it to her.
"Thank you."
"I'll see you again, I hope, Lizzie. Give my regards to your friend."
"Goodbye,"
she said, and lingered on the pavement till the car had turned the corner and gone out of sight before she set off towards the hornbeam trees. She had a feeling about that pale-haired man, and she wanted to ask the alethiometer. Will was reading his father's letters again. He sat on the terrace hearing the distant shouts of children diving off the harbour mouth, and read the clear handwriting on the flimsy airmail sheets, trying to picture the man who'd penned it, and looking again and again at the reference to the baby, to himself. He heard Lyra's running footsteps from some way off. He put the letters in his pocket and stood up, and almost at once Lyra was there, wild-eyed, with Pantalaimon, a snarling, savage wildcat, too distraught to hide. She, who seldom cried, was sobbing with rage. Her chest was heaving, her teeth were grinding, and she flung herself at him, clutching his arms, and cried,
"Kill him! Kill him! I want him dead! I wish Yorick was here! Oh, Will, I've done wrong! I'm so sorry!"
"What? What's the matter?"
"That old man! He ain't nothing but a low thief! He stole it, Will! He stole my alethiometer! That stinky old man with his rich clothes and his servant driving the car! Oh, I've done such wrong things this morning! Oh, I..."
And she sobbed so passionately he thought that hearts really did break, and hers was breaking now, for she fell to the ground wailing and shuddering, and Pantalaimon beside her became a wolf and howled with bitter grief. Far off across the water, children stopped what they were doing and shaded their eyes to see. Will sat down beside Lyra and shook her shoulder.
"Stop! Stop crying! Tell me from the beginning, what old man, what happened?"
"You're going to be so angry. I promised I wouldn't give you away. I promised it. And then..."
She sobbed, and Pantalaimon became a young, clumsy dog with lowered ears and wagging tail, squirming with self-abasement. And Will understood that Lyra had done something that she was too ashamed to tell him about, and he spoke to the demon.
"What happened? Just tell me."
"We went to the scholar, and there was someone else there. A man and a woman. And they tricked us. They asked a lot of questions, and then they asked about you. And before we could stop, we gave it away that we knew you, and then we ran away."
Lyra was hiding her face in her hands, pressing her head down against the pavement. Pantalaimon was flickering from shape to shape in his agitation. Dog, bird, cat, snow-white ermine.
"What did the man look like?"
"Big, and ever so strong, and pale eyes."
"Did he see you come back through the window?"
"No, but..."
"Well, he won't know where we are, then."
"But the alethiometer!"
she cried, and she sat up fiercely, her face rigid with emotion, like a Greek mask.
"Yeah. Tell me about that."
Between sobs and teeth grinding, she told him what had happened, how the old man had seen her using the alethiometer in the museum the day before, and how he'd stopped the car today and she'd got in to escape from the pale man, and how the car had pulled up on that side of the road so she'd had to climb past him to get out, and how he must have swiftly taken the alethiometer as he'd passed her the rucksack. He could see how devastated she was, but not why she should feel guilty. And then she said,
"And Will, please, I done something very bad, because the alethiometer told me I had to stop looking for dust. At least, I thought that's what it said, and I had to help you. I had to help you find your father. And I could take you to wherever he is if I had it, but I wouldn't listen. I just done what I wanted to do, and I shouldn't."
He'd seen her use it, and he knew it could tell her the truth. He turned away. She seized his wrist, but he broke away from her and walked to the edge of the water. The children were playing again across the harbour. Lyra ran up to him and said,
"Will, I'm so sorry!"
"What's the use of that? I don't care if you're sorry or not, you did it."
"But, Will, we got to help each other, you and me, because there ain't anyone else."
"I can't see how."
"Nor can I, but..."
She stopped in mid-sentence, and a light came into her eyes. She turned and raced back to her rucksack, abandoned on the pavement, and rummaged through it feverishly.
"I know who he is, and where he lives. Look!"
she said, and held up a little white card.
"He gave this to me in the museum. We can go and get the alethiometer back."
Will took the card and read,
"Sir Charles Latram, CBE. Limefield House, Old Headington, Oxford. He's a sir. A knight. That means people will automatically believe him and not us. What did you want me to do anyway? Go to the police? The police are after me. Or if they weren't yesterday, they will be by now. And if you go, they know who you are now, and they know you know me. So that wouldn't work either."
"We could steal it. We could go to his house and steal it. I know where Headington is. There's a Headington in my Oxford too. It ain't far. We could walk there in an hour, easy."
"You're stupid."
"Yorick Bernison would go there straight away and rip his head off.
I wish he was here. He...
But she fell silent. Will was just looking at her and she quailed. She would have quailed in the same way if the armoured bear had looked at her like that, because there was something not unlike Yorick in Will's eyes, young as they were.
I never heard anything so stupid in my life. You think we can just go to his house and creep in and steal it? You need to think. You need to use your bloody brain. He's going to have all kinds of burglar alarms and stuff if he's a rich man. There'll be bells that go off and special locks and lights with infrared switches that come on automatically.
I never heard of those things. We ain't got them in my world. I couldn't know that, Will.
All right, then. Think of this. He's got a whole house to hide it in. And how long would any burglar have to look through every cupboard and drawer and hiding place in a whole house? Those men who came to my house had hours to look around, and they never found what they were looking for. And I bet he's got a whole lot bigger house than we have. And probably a safe, too. So even if we did get into his house, we'd never find it in time before the police came.
She hung her head. It was all true.
What are we going to do, then?
He didn't answer. But it was we, for certain. He was bound to her now, whether he liked it or not. He walked to the water's edge, and back to the terrace, and back to the water again. He beat his hands together, looking for an answer, but no answer came, and he shook his head angrily.
Just go there. Just go there and see him. It's no good asking your scholar to help us either, not if the police have been to her. She's bound to believe them rather than us. At least if we get into his house, we'll see where the main rooms are. That'll be a start.
Without another word, he went inside and put the letters under the pillow in the room he'd slept in. Then, if he were caught, they'd never have them. Lyra was waiting on the terrace, with Pantalaimon perched on her shoulder as a sparrow. She was looking more cheerful.
We're going to get it back, all right. I can feel it.
He said nothing. They set off for the window. It took an hour and a half to walk to Headington. Lyra led the way, avoiding the city centre, and Will kept watch all around, saying nothing. It was much harder for Lyra now than it had been even in the Arctic, on the way to Bolvanger, for then she'd had the Egyptians and Yorick Birnison with her, and even if the tundra was full of danger, you knew the danger when you saw it. Here, in the city that was both hers and not hers, danger could look friendly, and treachery smiled and smelled sweet. And even if they weren't going to kill her or part her from Pantalaimon, they had robbed her of her only guide. Without the alethiometer, she was just a little girl, lost. Limefield House was the colour of warm honey, and half of its front was covered in Virginia creeper. It stood in a large, well-tended garden with shrubbery at one side and a gravel drive sweeping up to the front door. The Rolls-Royce was parked in front of a double garage to the left. Everything Will could see spoke of wealth and power, the sort of informal, settled superiority that some upper-class English people still took for granted. There was something about it that made him grit his teeth, and he didn't know why, until suddenly he remembered an occasion when he was very young. His mother had taken him to a house not unlike this. They'd dressed in their best clothes, and he'd had to be on his best behaviour, and an old man and woman had made his mother cry, and they'd left the house, and she was still crying. Lyra saw him breathing fast and clenching his fists, and was sensible enough not to ask why. It was something to do with him, not with her. Presently he took a deep breath.
Well, might as well try.
He walked up the drive and Lyra followed close behind. They felt very exposed. The door had an old-fashioned bell pull like those in Lyra's world, and Will didn't know where to find it till Lyra showed him. When they pulled it, the bell jangled a long way off inside the house. The man who opened the door was the servant who'd been driving the car, only now he didn't have his cap on. He looked at Will first and then at Lyra, and his expression changed a little.
We want to see Sir Charles Latram.
His jaw was jutting as it had done last night, facing the stone-throwing children by the tower. The servant nodded.
Wait here. I'll tell Sir Charles.
He closed the door. It was solid oak, with two heavy locks and bolts top and bottom, though Will thought that no sensible burglar would try the front door anyway. And there was a burglar alarm prominently fixed at the front of the house, and a large spotlight at each corner. They'd never be able to get near it, let alone break in. Steady footsteps came to the door, and then it opened again. Will looked up at the face of this man, who had so much that he wanted even more, and found him disconcertingly smooth and calm and powerful, not in the least guilty or ashamed. Sensing Lyra beside him, impatient and angry, Will said quickly,
"Excuse me, but Lyra thinks when she had a lift in your car earlier on, she left something in it by mistake."
Lyra? I don't know a Lyra. What an unusual name. I know a child called Lizzie. And who are you?
Cursing himself for forgetting, Will said,
I'm her brother, Mark.
I see. Hello, Lizzie, or Lyra. You'd better come in.
He stood aside. Neither Will nor Lyra was quite expecting this, and they stepped inside uncertainly. The hall was dim and smelled of beeswax and flowers. Every surface was polished and clean, and a mahogany cabinet against the wall contained dainty porcelain figures. Will saw the servant standing in the background, as if he were waiting to be called.
"Come into my study,"
said Sir Charles, and held open another door off the hall. He was being courteous, even welcoming, but there was an edge to his manner that put Will on guard. The study was large and comfortable in a cigar-smoke and leather armchair sort of way, and seemed to be full of bookshelves, pictures, hunting trophies. There were three or four glass-fronted cabinets containing antique scientific instruments, brass microscopes, telescopes covered in green leather, sextants, compasses. It was clear why he wanted the alethiometer.
"Sit down,"
said Sir Charles, and indicated a leather sofa. He sat at the chair behind his desk and went on.
"Well, what have you got to say?"
"You stole..."
began Lyra hotly, but Will looked at her and she stopped.
"Lyra thinks she left something in your car. We've come to get it back."
"Is this the object you mean?"
he said, and took a velvet cloth from a drawer in the desk. Lyra stood up. He ignored her and unfolded the cloth, disclosing the golden splendour of the alethiometer resting in his palm.
"Yes!"
Lyra burst out and reached for it. But he closed his hand. The desk was wide and she couldn't reach, and before she could do anything else, he swung around and placed the alethiometer in a glass-fronted cabinet before locking it and dropping the key in his waistcoat pocket.
"But it isn't yours, Lizzie. Or Lyra, if that's your name."
"It is mine! It's my alethiometer!"
He shook his head sadly and heavily, as if he were reproaching her, and it was a sorrow to him, but he was doing it for her own good.
"I think at the very least there's considerable doubt about the matter."
"But it is hers. Honestly, she's shown it to me. I know it's hers."
"You see, I think you'd have to prove that. I don't have to prove anything, because it's in my possession. It's assumed to be mine, like all the other items in my collection. I must say, Lyra, I'm surprised to find you so dishonest."
"I ain't dishonest."
"Oh, but you are. You told me your name was Lizzie. Now I learn it's something else. Frankly, you haven't got a hope of convincing anyone that a precious piece like this belongs to you. I tell you what, let's call the police."
He turned his head to call for the servant.
"No, wait,"
said Will, before Sir Charles could speak. But Lyra ran around the desk, and from nowhere Pantalaimon was in her arms, a snarling wildcat baring his teeth and hissing at the old man. Sir Charles blinked at the sudden appearance of the demon, but hardly flinched.
"You don't even know what it is you stole! You seen me using it and you thought you'd steal it, and you did! But you're worse than my mother! At least she knows it's important! You're just going to put it in a case and do nothing with it! You ought to die! If I can, I'll make someone kill you! You're not worth leaving alive! You're..."
She couldn't speak. All she could do was spit full in his face, so she did, with all her might. Will sat still, watching, looking around, memorizing where everything was. Sir Charles calmly shook out a silk handkerchief and mopped himself.
"Have you any control over yourself? Go and sit down, you filthy brat."
Lyra felt tears shaken out of her eyes by the trembling of her body and threw herself onto the sofa. Pantalaimon, his thick cat's tail erect, stood on her lap with his blazing eyes fixed on the old man. Will sat silent and puzzled. Sir Charles could have thrown them out long before this. What was he playing at? And then he saw something so bizarre he thought he'd imagined it. Out of the sleeve of Sir Charles's linen jacket, past the snowy white shirt cuff, came the emerald head of a snake. Its black tongue flicked this way, that way, and its mailed head with its gold-rimmed black eyes moved from Lyra to Will and back again. She was too angry to see it at all, and Will saw it only for a moment before it retreated again up the old man's sleeve, but it made his eyes widen with shock. Sir Charles moved to the window seat and calmly sat down, arranging the crease in his trousers.
"I think you'd better listen to me instead of behaving in this uncontrolled way. You really haven't any choice. The instrument is in my possession and will stay there. I want it. I'm a collector. You can spit and stamp and scream all you like, but by the time you've persuaded anyone else to listen to you, I shall have plenty of documents to prove that I bought it. I can do that very easily. and then you'll never get it back.
They were both silent now. He hadn't finished. A great puzzlement was slowing Lyra's heartbeat and making the room very still.
However, there's something I want even more, and I can't get it myself. So I'm prepared to make a deal with you. You fetch the object I want, and I'll give you back the, what did you call it?
Alethiometer.
Alethiometer? How interesting. Alethea, truth. Those emblems. Yes, I see.
What's this thing you want, and where is it?
It's somewhere I can't go, but you can. I'm perfectly well aware that you've found a doorway somewhere. I guess it's not too far from Summertown, where I dropped Lizzie, or Lyra, this morning. And that through the doorway is another world. One with no grown-ups in it. Right so far? Well, you see, the man who made that doorway has got a knife. He's hiding in that other world right now, and he's extremely afraid. He has reason to be. If he's where I think he is, he's in an old stone tower with angels carved around the doorway. The Torre degli Angeli. So that's where you have to go. And I don't care how you do it, but I want that knife. Bring it to me, and you can have the alethiometer. I shall be sorry to lose it, but I'm a man of my word. That's what you have to do. Bring me the knife.
Chapter 8. The Tower of the Angels. Will said,
"Who is this man who's got the knife?"
They were in the Rolls-Royce, driving up through Oxford. Sir Charles sat in the front, half turned around, and Will and Lyra sat in the back, with Pantalaimon a mouse now, soothed in Lyra's hands.
"Someone who has no more right to the knife than I have to the alethiometer. Unfortunately for all of us, the alethiometer is in my possession and the knife is in his."
"How do you know about the other world anyway?"
"I know many things that you don't. What else would you expect? I'm a good deal older and considerably better informed. There are a number of doorways between this world and that. Those who know where they are can easily pass back and forth. In Chittagatse, there's a guild of learned men, so-called, who used to do so all the time."
"You ain't from this world at all. You're from there, ain't you?"
And again came that strange nudge at her memory. She was almost certain she'd seen him before.
"No, I'm not."
"If we've got to get the knife from that man, we need to know more about him. He's not going to just give it to us, is he?"
"Certainly not. It's the one thing keeping the spectres away. It's not going to be easy by any means."
"The spectres are afraid of the knife."
"Very much so."
"Why do they attack only grown-ups?"
"You don't need to know that now. It doesn't matter. Lyra,"
Sir Charles said, turning to her,
"tell me about your remarkable friend."
He meant Pantalaimon. And as soon as he said it, Will realized that the snake he'd seen concealed in the man's sleeve was a demon too, and that Sir Charles must come from Lyra's world. He was asking about Pantalaimon to put them off the track, so he didn't realize that Will had seen his own demon. Lyra lifted Pantalaimon close to her breast, and he became a black rat, whipping his tail around and around her wrist and glaring at Sir Charles with red eyes.
"You weren't supposed to see him. He's my demon. You think you ain't got demons in this world, but you have. Yours would be a dung beetle."
"If the pharaohs of Egypt were content to be represented by a scarab, so am I." "Well, you're from yet another world. How interesting. Is that where the alethiometer comes from, or did you steal it on your travels?"
"I was given it. The master of Jordan College in my Oxford gave it to me. It's mine by right, and you wouldn't know what to do with it, you stupid, stinky old man. You'd never read it in 100 years. It's just a toy to you. But I need it, and so does Will. We'll get it back, don't worry."
"We'll see. This is where I dropped you before. Shall we let you out here?"
"No,"
said Will, because he could see a police car farther down the road.
"You can't come into Jigatse because of the spectres, so it doesn't matter if you know where the window is. Take us farther up toward the ring road."
"As you wish. When or if you get the knife, call my number and Alan will come to pick you up."
They said no more till the chauffeur drew the car to a halt. As they got out, Sir Charles lowered his window and said to Will,
"By the way, if you can't get the knife, don't bother to return. Come to my house without it and I'll call the police. I imagine they'll be there at once, when I tell them your real name. It is William Parry, isn't it? Yes, I thought so. There's a very good photo of you in today's paper.
And the car pulled away. Will was speechless. Lyra was shaking his arm.
It's all right. He won't tell anyone else. He would have done it already if he was going to. Come on!
10 minutes later, they stood in the little square at the foot of the Tower of the Angels. Will had told her about the snake demon, and she had stopped still in the street, tormented again by that half-memory. Who was the old man? Where had she seen him? It was no good. The memory wouldn't come clear.
I didn't want to tell him, but I saw a man up there last night. He looked down when the kids were making all that noise.
What did he look like?
Young, with curly hair. Not old at all. But I saw him for only a moment, at the very top, over those battlements. I thought he might be... You remember Angelica and Paolo? And Paolo said they had an older brother, and he'd come into the city as well. And she made Paolo stop telling us, as if it was a secret. Well, I thought it might be him. He might be after this knife as well. And I reckon all the kids know about it. I think that's the real reason why they come back in the first place.
He said, looking up.
Maybe.
She remembered the children talking earlier that morning. No children would go in the tower, they'd said. There were scary things in there. And she remembered her own feeling of unease as she and Pantalaimon had looked through the open door before leaving the city. Maybe that was why they needed a grown man to go in there. Her demon was fluttering around her head now, moth-formed in the bright sunlight, whispering anxiously.
Hush!
She whispered back.
There ain't any choice, Pan. It's our fault. We've got to make it right, and this is the only way.
Will walked off to the right, following the wall of the tower. At the corner, a narrow cobbled alley led between it and the next building, and Will went down there too, looking up, getting the measure of the place. Lyra followed. Will stopped under a window at the second-story level and said to Pantalaimon,
"Can you fly up there? Can you look in?"
He became a sparrow at once and set off. He could only just reach it. Lyra gasped and gave a little cry when he was at the windowsill, and he perched there for a second or two before diving down again. She sighed and took deep breaths like someone rescued from drowning. Will frowned, puzzled.
It's hard when your demon goes away from you. It hurts.
Oh, sorry. Did you see anything?
Stairs. Stairs and dark rooms. There were swords hung on the wall and spears and shields like a museum. And I saw the young man. He was dancing.
Dancing?
Moving to and fro, waving his hand about. Or as if he was fighting something invisible. I just saw him through an open door, not clearly.
Fighting a spectre?
Lyra guessed, but they couldn't guess any better, so they moved on. Behind the tower, a high stone wall, topped with broken glass, enclosed a small garden with formal beds of herbs around a fountain. Once again, Pantalaimon flew up to look. And then there was an alley on the other side, bringing them back to the square. The windows around the tower were small and deeply set, like frowning eyes.
We'll have to go in the front, then,
said Will. He climbed the steps and pushed the door wide. Sunlight struck in and the heavy hinges creaked. He took a step or two inside, and seeing no one, went in further. Lyra followed close behind. The floor was made of flagstones worn smooth over centuries, and the air inside was cool. Will looked at a flight of steps going downward, and went far enough down to see that it opened into a wide, low-ceilinged room with an immense cold furnace at one end, where the plaster walls were black with soot. But there was no one there, and he went up to the entrance hall again, where he found Lyra with her finger to her lips, looking up.
I can hear him. He's talking to himself, I reckon.
Will listened hard and heard it too. A low, crooning murmur interrupted occasionally by a harsh laugh or a short cry of anger. It sounded like the voice of a madman. Will blew out his cheeks and set off to climb the staircase. It was made of blackened oak, immense and broad, with steps as worn as the flagstones, far too solid to creak underfoot. The light diminished as they climbed because the only illumination was the small, deep-set window on each landing. They climbed up one floor, stopped and listened, climbed the next, and the sound of the man's voice was now mixed with that of halting, rhythmic footsteps. It came from a room across the landing, whose door stood ajar. Will tiptoed to it and pushed it open another few inches so he could see. It was a large room with cobwebs thickly clustered on the ceiling. The walls were lined with bookshelves containing badly preserved volumes with the bindings crumbling and flaking or distorted with damp. Several of them lay thrown off the shelves, open on the floor or the wide, dusty tables, and others had been thrust back higgledy-piggledy. In the centre of the room, a young man was dancing. Pantalaimon was right. It looked exactly like that. He had his back to the door, and he'd shuffled to one side, then to the other, and all the time his right hand moved in front of him as if he were clearing a way through some invisible obstacles. In that hand was a knife, not a special-looking knife, just a dull blade about 8 inches long, and he'd thrust it forward, slice it sideways, feel forward with it, jab up and down, all in the empty air. He moved as if to turn, and Will withdrew. He put a finger to his lips and beckoned to Lyra, and led her to the stairs and up to the next floor.
"What's he doing?"
He described it as well as he could.
"He sounds mad. Is he thin? With curly hair?"
"Yes. Red hair, like Angelica's. He certainly looks mad. Oh, I don't know. I think this is odder than Sir Charles said. Let's look farther up before we speak to him."
She didn't question, but let him lead them up another staircase to the top story. It was much lighter up there, because a white-painted flight of steps led up to the roof, or rather to a wood and glass structure like a little greenhouse. Even at the foot of the steps they could feel the heat it was absorbing. And as they stood there they heard a groan from above. They jumped. They'd been sure there was only one man in the tower. Pantalaimon was so startled that he changed at once from a cat to a bird, and flew to Lyra's breast. Will and Lyra realized as he did so that they'd seized each other's hand, and let go slowly.
"Better go and see. I'll go first."
"I ought to go first, seeing it's my fault."
"Seeing it's your fault, you've got to do as I say."
She twisted her lip, but fell in behind him. He climbed up into the sun. The light in the glass structure was blinding. It was as hot as a greenhouse, too, and Will could neither see nor breathe easily. He found a door handle and turned it and stepped out quickly, holding his hand up to keep the sun out of his eyes. He found himself on a roof of lead, enclosed by the battlemented parapet. The glass structure was set in the centre, and the lead sloped slightly downward all round toward a gutter inside the parapet, with square drainage holes in the stone for rainwater. Lying on the lead, in the full sun, was an old man with white hair. His face was bruised and battered, and one eye was closed, and as they saw when they got closer, his hands were tied behind him. He heard them coming and groaned again and tried to turn over to shield himself.
"It's all right. We aren't going to hurt you. Did the man with the knife do this?"
The old man grunted.
"Let's undo the rope. He hasn't tied it very well."
It was clumsily and hastily knotted, and it fell away quickly once Will had seen how to work it. They helped the old man to get up and took him over to the shade of the parapet.
"Who are you? We didn't think there were two people here. We thought there was only one."
"Giacomo Paradisi,"
the old man muttered through broken teeth.
"I am the bearer, no one else. That young man stole it from me. There are always fools who take risks like that for the sake of the knife, but this one is desperate. He is going to kill me."
"No, he ain't. What's the bearer? What's that mean?"
"I hold this subtle knife on behalf of the guild. Where is he gone?"
"He's downstairs. We came up past him. He didn't see us. He was waving it about in the air."
"Trying to cut through. He won't succeed. When he..."
"Watch out!"
Will turned. The young man was climbing up into the little wooden shelter. He hadn't seen them yet, but there was nowhere to hide. And as they stood up, he saw the movement and whipped around to face them. Immediately Pantalaimon became a bear and reared up on his hind legs. Only Lyra knew that he wouldn't be able to touch the other man, and certainly the other blinked and stared for a second. But Will saw that he hadn't really registered it. The man was crazy. His curly red hair was matted, his chin was flecked with spit, and the whites of his eyes showed all around the pupils. And he had the knife, and they had no weapons at all. Will stepped up the lead, away from the old man, crouching, ready to jump or fight or leap out of the way. The young man sprang forward and slashed at him with the knife, left, right, left, coming closer and closer, making Will back away till he was trapped in the angle where two sides of the tower met. Lyra was scrambling towards the man from behind with the loose rope in her hand. Will darted forward suddenly, just as he'd done to the man in his house, and with the same effect. His antagonist tumbled backwards unexpectedly, falling over Lyra to crash onto the lead. It was all happening too quickly for Will to be frightened, but he did have time to see the knife fly from the man's hand and sink at once into the lead some feet away, point first, with no more resistance than if it had fallen into butter. It plunged as far as the hilt and stopped suddenly. And the young man twisted over and reached for it at once, but Will flung himself on his back and seized his hair. He had learned to fight at school. There had been plenty of occasion for it once the other children had sensed that there was something the matter with his mother. And he'd learned that the object of a school fight was not to gain points for style, but to force your enemy to give in, which meant hurting him more than he was hurting you. He knew that you had to be willing to hurt someone else, too, and he'd found out that not many people were when it came to it. But he knew that he was. So this wasn't unfamiliar to him, but he hadn't fought against a nearly grown man armed with a knife before, and at all costs he must keep the man from picking it up now that he'd dropped it. Will twisted his fingers into the young man's thick, damp hair and wrenched back as hard as he could. The man grunted and flung himself sideways, but Will hung on even tighter, and his opponent roared with pain and anger. He pushed up and then threw himself backwards, crushing Will between himself and the parapet, and that was too much. All the breath left Will's body, and in the shock his hands loosened. The man pulled free. Will dropped to his knees in the gutter, winded badly, but he couldn't stay there. He tried to stand, and in doing so he thrust his foot through one of the drainage holes. His fingers scraped desperately on the warm lead, and for a horrible second he thought he would slide off the roof to the ground. But nothing happened. His left leg was thrust out into empty space. The rest of him was safe. He pulled his leg back inside the parapet and scrambled to his feet. The man had reached his knife again, but he didn't have time to pull it out of the lead before Lyra leapt onto his back, scratching, kicking, biting like a wildcat. But she missed the hold on his hair that she was trying for, and he threw her off. And when he got up, he had the knife in his hand. Lyra had fallen to one side, with Pantalaimon a wildcat now, fur raised, teeth bared, beside her. Will faced the man directly and saw him clearly for the first time. There was no doubt. He was Angelica's brother, all right, and he was vicious. All his mind was focused on Will, and the knife was in his hand. But Will wasn't harmless, either. He'd seized the rope when Lyra dropped it, and now he wrapped it around his left hand for protection against the knife. He moved sideways between the young man and the sun, so that his antagonist had to squint and blink. Even better, the glass structure threw brilliant reflections into his eyes, and Will could see that for a moment he was almost blinded. He leapt to the man's left, away from the knife, holding his left hand high, and kicked hard at the man's knee. He'd taken care to aim, and his foot connected well. The man went down with a loud grunt and twisted away awkwardly. Will leapt after him, kicking again and again, kicking whatever parts he could reach, driving the man back and back towards the glass house. If he could get him to the top of the stairs. This time the man fell more heavily, and his right hand, with the knife in it, came down on the lead at Will's feet. Will stamped on it at once, hard, crushing the man's fingers between the hilt and the lead, and then wrapped the rope more tightly around his hand and stamped a second time. The man yelled and let go of the knife. At once Will kicked it away, his shoe connecting with the hilt, luckily for him, and it spun across the lead and came to rest in the gutter just beside a drainage hole. The rope had come loose around his hand once more, and there seemed to be a surprising amount of blood from somewhere sprinkled on the lead and on his own shoes. The man was pulling himself up.
"Look out!"
shouted Lyra, but Will was ready. At the moment when the man was off balance, he threw himself at him, crashing as hard as he could into the man's midriff. The man fell backward into the glass, which shattered at once, and the flimsy wooden frame went too. He sprawled among the wreckage, half over the stairwell, and grabbed the door frame, but it had nothing to support it any more, and it gave way. He fell downward, and more glass fell all around him. And Will darted back to the gutter and picked up the knife, and the fight was over. The young man, cut and battered, clambered up the step and saw Will standing above him, holding the knife. He stared with a sickly anger and then turned and fled. Said Will, sitting down. Something was badly wrong, and he hadn't noticed it. He dropped the knife and hugged his left hand to himself. The tangle of rope was sodden with blood, and when he pulled it away...
Your fingers! Oh, Will!
His little finger and the finger next to it fell away with the rope. His head swam. Blood was pulsing strongly from the stumps where his fingers had been, and his jeans and shoes were sodden already. He had to lie back and close his eyes for a moment. The pain wasn't that great, and a part of his mind registered that with a dull surprise. It was like a persistent, deep hammer thud more than the bright, sharp clarity when you cut yourself superficially. He'd never felt so weak. He supposed he had gone to sleep for a moment. Lyra was doing something to his arm. He sat up to look at the damage and felt sick. The old man was somewhere close by, but Will couldn't see what he was doing, and meanwhile Lyra was talking to him.
If only we had some blood moss, what the bears use, I could make it better, Will, I could. Look, I'm going to tie this bit of rope around your arm to stop the bleeding, because I can't tie it around where your fingers were. There's nothing to tie it to. Hold still.
He let her do it, then looked around for his fingers. There they were, curled like a bloody quotation mark on the lid. He laughed.
Hey, stop that. Get up now. Mr. Paradisi's got some medicine, some salve. I don't know what it is. You've got to come downstairs. The other man's gone. We seen him run out the door. He's gone now. You beat him. Come on, Will. Come on.
Nagging and cajoling, she urged him down the steps, and they picked their way through the shattered glass and splintered wood and into a small, cool room off the landing. The walls were lined with shelves of bottles, jars, pots, pestles and mortars and chemist's balances. Under the dirty window was a stone sink, where the old man was pouring something with a shaky hand from a large bottle into a smaller one.
"Sit down and drink this,"
he said, and filled a small glass with a dark golden liquid. Will sat down and took the glass. The first mouthful hit the back of his throat like fire. Lyra took the glass to stop it from falling as Will gasped.
"Drink it all."
"What is it?"
"Plum brandy. Drink."
Will sipped it more cautiously. Now his hand was really beginning to hurt.
"Can you heal him?"
"Oh, yes. We have medicines for everything. You, girl, open the drawer in the table and bring out a bandage."
Will saw the knife lying on the table in the center of the room, but before he could pick it up, the old man was limping towards him with a bowl of water.
"Drink again."
Will held the glass tightly and closed his eyes while the old man did something to his hand. It stung horribly, but then he felt the rough friction of a towel on his wrist and something mopping the wound more gently. Then there was a coolness for a moment, and it hurt again.
"This is precious ointment. Very difficult to obtain. Very good for wounds."
It was a dusty, battered tube of ordinary antiseptic cream, such as Will could have bought in any pharmacy in his world. The old man was handling it as if it were made of myrrh. Will looked away. And while the man was dressing the wound, Lyra felt Pantalaimon calling to her silently to come and look out the window. He was a kestrel perching on the open window frame, and his eyes had caught a movement below. She joined him and saw a familiar figure. The girl Angelica was running towards her elder brother Tullio, who stood with his back against the wall on the other side of the narrow street, waving his arms in the air as if trying to keep a flock of bats from his face. Then he turned away and began to run his hands along the stones in the wall, looking closely at each one, counting them, feeling the edges, hunching up his shoulders as if to ward off something behind him, shaking his head. Angelica was desperate, and so was little Paolo behind her, and they reached their brother and seized his arms and tried to pull him away from whatever was troubling him. And Lyra realized with a jolt of sickness what was happening. The man was being attacked by spectres. Angelica knew it, though she couldn't see them, of course, and little Paolo was crying and striking at the empty air to try and drive them off. But it didn't help, and Tullio was lost. His movements became more and more lethargic, and presently they stopped altogether. Angelica clung to him, shaking and shaking his arm, but nothing woke him, and Paolo was crying his brother's name over and over as if that would bring him back. Then Angelica seemed to feel Lyra watching her, and she looked up. For a moment their eyes met. Lyra felt a jolt as if the girl had struck her a physical blow, because the hatred in her eyes was so intense. And then Paolo saw her looking and looked up too, and his little boy's voice cried,
"We'll kill you! You've done this to Tullio! We're going to kill you, all right!"
The two children turned and ran, leaving their stricken brother. And Lyra, frightened and guilty, withdrew inside the room again and shut the window. The others hadn't heard. Giacomo Paradisi was dabbing more ointment on the wounds, and Lyra tried to put what she'd seen out of her mind and focused on Will.
"You've got to tie something around his arm to stop the bleeding. It won't stop otherwise."
Yes, I know.
Will kept his eyes averted while they did up a bandage and drank the plum brandy sip by sip. Presently he felt soothed and distant, though his hand was hurting abominably.
"Now, here you are. Take the knife. It is yours."
"I don't want it. I don't want anything to do with it."
"You haven't got the choice. You are the bearer now."
"I thought you said you was..."
"My time is over. The knife knows when to leave one hand and settle in another, and I know how to tell. You don't believe me? Look."
He held up his own left hand. The little finger and the finger next to it were missing, just like Will's.
"Yes, me too. I fought and lost the same fingers, the badge of the bearer, and I did not know either in advance.
Lyra sat down, wide-eyed. Will held on to the dusty table with his good hand. He struggled to find words.
We only came here because there was a man who stole something of Lyra's, and he wanted the knife, and he said if we brought him that, then he...
I know that man. He is a liar, a cheat. He won't give you anything. Make no mistake. He wants the knife, and once he has it, he will betray you. He will never be the bearer. The knife is yours by right.
With a heavy reluctance, Will turned to the knife itself. He pulled it towards him. It was an ordinary-looking dagger with a double-sided blade of dull metal about 8 inches long, a short crosspiece of the same metal, and a handle of rosewood. As he looked at it more closely, he saw that the rosewood was inlaid with golden wires, forming a design he didn't recognize till he turned the knife around and saw an angel with wings folded. On the other side was a different angel with wings upraised. The wires stood out a little from the surface, giving a firm grip, and as he picked it up he felt that it was light in his hand and strong and beautifully balanced, and that the blade was not dull after all. In fact, a swirl of cloudy colours seemed to live just under the surface of the metal. Bruised purples, sea blues, earth browns, cloud greys, the deep green under heavy foliage trees, the clustering shades at the mouth of a tomb as evening falls over a deserted graveyard. If there was such a thing as shadow-coloured, it was the blade of the subtle knife. But the edges were different. In fact, the two edges differed from each other. One was clear, bright steel, merging a little way back into those subtle shadow colours, but steel of an incomparable sharpness. Will's eye shrank back from looking at it, so sharp did it seem. The other edge was just as keen, but silvery in colour, and Lyra, who was looking at it over Will's shoulder, said,
"I've seen that colour before. That's the same as the blade they was going to cut me and Pan apart with. That's just the same."
"This edge,"
said Giacomo Paradisi, touching the steel with the handle of a spoon,
"will cut through any material in the world. Look."
And he pressed the silver spoon against the blade. Will, holding the knife, felt only the slightest resistance as the tip of the spoon's handle fell to the table, cut clean off.
"The other edge is more subtle still. With it, you can cut an opening out of this world altogether. Try it now. Do as I say. You are the bearer. You have to know. No one can teach you but me, and I have not much time left. Stand up and listen."
Will pushed his chair back and stood, holding the knife loosely. He felt dizzy, sick, rebellious.
"I don't want..."
he began, but Giacomo Paradisi shook his head.
"Be silent. You don't want. You don't want. You have no choice. Listen to me, because time is short. Now, hold the knife out ahead of you. Like that. It's not only the knife that has to cut. It's your own mind. You have to think it. So do this. Put your mind out at the very tip of the knife. Concentrate, boy. Focus your mind. Don't think about your wound. It will heal. Think about the knife tip. That is where you are. Now, feel with it very gently. You're looking for a gap so small you could never see it with your eyes. But the knife tip will find it if you put your mind there. Feel along the air till you sense the smallest little gap in the world."
Will tried to do it, but his head was buzzing and his left hand throbbed horribly, and he saw his two fingers again lying on the roof. And then he thought of his mother, his poor mother. What would she say? How would she comfort him? How could he ever comfort her? And he put the knife down on the table and crouched low, hugging his wounded hand, and cried. It was all too much to bear. The sobs racked his throat and his chest, and the tears dazzled him. And he should be crying for her, the poor, frightened, unhappy, dear beloved. He'd left her. He'd left her. He was desolate. But then he felt the strangest thing, and brushed the back of his right wrist across his eyes to find Pantaliman's head on his knee. The demon, in the form of a wolfhound, was gazing up at him with melting, sorrowing eyes, and then he gently licked Will's wounded hand again and again, and laid his head on Will's knee once more. Will had no idea of the taboo in Lyra's world, preventing one person from touching another's demon. And if he hadn't touched Pantalaimon before, it was politeness that had held him back and not knowledge. Lyra, in fact, was breathtaken. Her demon had done it on his own initiative, and now he withdrew and fluttered to her shoulder as the smallest of moths. The old man was watching, with interest but not incredulity. He'd seen demons before, somehow. He'd travelled to other worlds, too. Pantalaimon's gesture had worked. Will swallowed hard and stood up again, wiping the tears out of his eyes.
All right. I'll try again. Tell me what to do.
This time he forced his mind to do what Giacomo Paradisi said, gritting his teeth, trembling with exertion, sweating. Lyra was bursting to interrupt, because she knew this process. So did Dr. Malone, and so did the poet Keats, whoever he was, and all of them knew you couldn't get it by straining towards it. But she held her tongue and clasped her hands.
Stop! Relax! Don't push! This is a subtle knife, not a heavy sword. You're gripping it too tight. Loosen your fingers. Let your mind wander down your arm to your wrist, and then into the handle, and out along the blade. No hurry. Go gently. Don't force it. Just wander. Then along to the very tip, where the edge is sharpest of all. You become the tip of the knife. Just do that now. Go there and feel that. And then come back.
Will tried again. Lyra could see the intensity in his body, saw his jaw working, and then saw an authority descend over it, calming and relaxing and clarifying. The authority was Will's own, or his demon's, perhaps. How he must miss having a demon? The loneliness of it. No wonder he'd cried. And it was right of Pantalaimon to do what he'd done, though it had felt so strange to her. She reached up to her beloved demon, and, ermine-shaped, he flowed onto her lap. They watched together as Will's body stopped trembling. No less intense, he was focused differently now, and the knife looked different, too. Perhaps it was those cloudy colours along the blade, or perhaps it was the way it sat so naturally in Will's hand, but the little movements he was making with the tip now looked purposeful instead of random. He felt this way, then turned the knife over and felt the other, always feeling with the silvery edge, and then he seemed to find some little snag in the empty air.
What's this? Is this it?
Yes. Don't force it. Come back now. Come back to yourself.
Lyra imagined she could see Will's soul flowing back along the blade to his hand and up his arm to his heart. He stood back, dropped his hand, blinked.
I felt something there. The knife was just slipping through the air at first, and then I felt it.
Good. Now do it again. This time when you feel it, slide the knife in and along. Make a cut. Don't hesitate. Don't be surprised. Don't drop the knife.
Will had to crouch and take two or three deep breaths and put his left hand under his other arm before he could go on. But he was intent on it. He stood up again after a couple of seconds, the knife held forward already. This time it was easier. Having felt it once, he knew what to search for again, and he felt the curious little snag after less than a minute. It was like delicately searching out the gap between one stitch and the next with the point of a scalpel. He touched, withdrew, touched again to make sure, and then did as the old man had said, and cut sideways with the silver edge. It was a good thing that Giacomo Paradisi had reminded him not to be surprised. He kept careful hold of the knife and put it down on the table before giving in to his astonishment. Lyra was on her feet already, speechless, because there in the middle of the dusty little room was a window just like the one under the hornbeam trees, a gap in mid-air through which they could see another world. And because they were high in the tower, they were high above North Oxford. Over a cemetery, in fact, looking back towards the city. There were the hornbeam trees a little way ahead of them. There were houses, trees, roads, and in the distance the towers and spires of the city. If they hadn't already seen the first window, they would have thought this was some kind of optical trick. Except that it wasn't only optical. Air was coming through it, and they could smell the traffic fumes which didn't exist in the world of Chitagatse. Pantalaimon changed into a swallow and flew through, delighting in the open air, and then snapped up an insect before darting back to Lyra's shoulder again. Giacomo Paradisi was watching with a curious, sad smile. Then he said,
"So much for opening. Now you must learn to close.
Lyra stood back to give Will room, and the old man came to stand beside him.
For this you need your fingers. One hand will do. Feel for the edge as you felt with a knife to begin with. You won't find it unless you put your soul into your fingertips. Touch very delicately. Feel again and again till you find the edge. Then you pinch it together. That's all. Try.
But Will was trembling. He couldn't get his mind back to the delicate balance he knew it needed, and he got more and more frustrated. Lyra could see what was happening. She stood up and took his right arm and said,
Listen, Will, sit down. I'll tell you how to do it. Just sit down for a minute, because your hand hurts and it's taking your mind off it. It's bound to. It leaves off in a little while.
The old man raised both his hands and then changed his mind, shrugged, and sat down again. Will sat down and looked at Lyra.
What am I doing wrong?
He was blood-stained, trembling, wild-eyed. He was living on the edge of his nerves, clenching his jaw, tapping his foot, breathing fast.
It's your wound. You ain't wrong at all. You're doing it right, but your hand won't let you concentrate on it. I don't know an easy way of getting around that, except maybe if you didn't try to shut it out.
What do you mean?
Well, you're trying to do two things with your mind both at once. You're trying to ignore the pain and close that window. I remember when I was reading the alethiometer once, when I was frightened, and maybe I was used to it by that time, I don't know, but I was still frightened all the time I was reading it. Just sort of relax your mind and say, yes, it does hurt, I know. Don't try and shut it out.
His eyes closed briefly. His breathing slowed a little.
All right. I'll try that.
And this time it was much easier. He felt for the edge, found it within a minute, and did as Giacomo Paradisi had told him, pinched the edges together. It was the easiest thing in the world. He felt a brief, calm exhilaration, and then the window was gone. The other world was shut. The old man handed him a leather sheath, backed with stiff horn, with buckles to hold the knife in place, because the slightest sideways movement of the blade would have cut through the thickest leather. Will slid the knife into it and buckled it as tight as he could with his clumsy hand.
This should be a solemn occasion. If we had days and weeks, I could begin to tell you the story of the subtle knife, and the guild of the Torri degli Angeli, and the whole sorry history of this corrupt and careless world. The spectres are our fault. Our fault alone. They came because my predecessors, alchemists, philosophers, men of learning, were making an inquiry into the deepest nature of things. They became curious about the bonds that held the smallest particles of matter together. You know what I mean by a bond? Something that binds? Well, this was a mercantile city, a city of traders and bankers. We thought we knew about bonds. We thought a bond was something negotiable, something that could be bought and sold and exchanged and converted. But about these bonds, we were wrong. We undid them and we let the spectres in.
Where did the spectres come from? Why was the window left open under those trees, the one we first came in through? Are there other windows in the world?
Where the spectres come from is a mystery. From another world. From the darkness of space. Who knows? What matters is that they are here, and they have destroyed us. Are there other windows into this world? Yes, a few, because sometimes a knife-bearer might be careless or forgetful, without time to stop and close as he should. And the window you came through, under the hornbeam trees, I left that open myself in a moment of unforgivable foolishness. There is a man I am afraid of, and I thought to tempt him through and into the city, where he would fall victim to the spectres, but I think that he is too clever for a trick like that. He wants the knife. Please, never let him get it.
Will and Lyra shared a glance.
Well,
the old man finished, spreading his hands.
All I can do is hand the knife on to you and show you how to use it, which I have done, and tell you what the rules of the guild used to be before it decayed. First, never open without closing. Second, never let anyone else use the knife. It is yours alone. Third, never use it for a base purpose. Fourth, keep it secret. If there are other rules, I have forgotten them. And if I've forgotten them, it is because they don't matter. You have the knife. You are the bearer. You should not be a child. But our world is crumbling. And the mark of the bearer is unmistakable. I don't even know your name. Now, go. I shall die very soon, because I know where there are poisonous drugs, and I don't intend to wait for the specters to come in, as they will once the knife has left. Go.
But Mr. Paradiso...
There is no time. You have come here for a purpose, and maybe you don't know what that purpose is, but the angels do, who brought you here. Go. You are brave, and your friend is clever, and you have the knife. Go.
You weren't really going to poison yourself.
Come on.
And what did you mean about angels?
Will tugged her arm.
Come on. We got to go. Thank you, Mr. Paradisi.
He held out his blood-stained, dusty right hand, and the old man shook it gently. He shook Lyra's hand, too, and nodded to Pantalaimon, who lowered his ermine head in acknowledgement. Clutching the knife in its leather sheath, Will led the way down the broad, dark stairs and out of the tower. The sunlight was hot in the little square, and the silence was profound. Lyra looked all around with immense caution, but the street was empty. And it would be better not to worry Will about what she'd seen. There was quite enough to worry about already. She led him away from the street where she'd seen the children, where the stricken Tullio was standing, as still as death.
I wish...
Lyra said when they had nearly left the square, stopping to look back up.
It's horrible, thinking of... And his poor teeth was all broken, and he could hardly see out his eye. He's just going to swallow some poison and die now. And I wish...
She was on the verge of tears.
Hush. It won't hurt him. He'll just go to sleep. It's better than the spectres, he said.
Oh, what are we going to do, Will? What are we going to do? You're hurt so bad, and that poor old man. I hate this place, I really do. I'd burn it to the ground. What are we going to do now?
Well, that's easy. We've got to get the alethiometer back, so we'll have to steal it. That's what we're going to do.
Chapter 9. Theft. First they went back to the cafe to recover and rest and change their clothes. It was clear that Will couldn't go everywhere covered in blood, and the time of feeling guilty about taking things from shops was over. So he gathered a complete set of new clothes and shoes, and Lyra, demanding to help, and watching in every direction for the other children, carried them back to the cafe. Lyra put some water on to boil, and Will took it up to the bathroom and stripped to wash from head to foot. The pain was dull and unrelenting, but at least the cuts were clean, and having seen what the knife could do, he knew that no cuts could be cleaner. But the stumps where his fingers had been were bleeding freely. When he looked at them, he felt sick, and his heart beat faster, and that in turn seemed to make the bleeding even worse. He sat on the edge of the bath and closed his eyes and breathed deeply several times. Presently he felt calmer and set himself to washing. He did the best he could, drying himself on the increasingly bloodied towels, and then dressed in his new clothes, trying not to make them bloody too.
"You're going to have to tie my bandage again,"
he said to Lyra.
"I don't care how tight you make it, as long as it stops the bleeding."
She tore up a sheet and wrapped it around and around, clamping it down over the wounds as tight as she could. He gritted his teeth, but he couldn't help the tears. He brushed them away without a word, and she said nothing. When she'd finished, he said,
Thank you. Listen, I want you to take something in your rucksack for me in case we can't come back here. It's only letters. You can read them if you want.
He went to the bedroom, took out the green leather writing case, and handed her the sheets of airmail paper.
I won't read them unless...
I don't mind. Elsa wouldn't have said.
She folded up the letters, and he lay on the bed, pushed the cat aside, and fell asleep. Much later that night, Will and Lyra crouched in the lane that ran along beside the tree-shaded shrubbery in Sir Charles's garden. On the Chittagatse side, they were in a grassy park surrounding a classical villa that gleamed white in the moonlight. They'd taken a long time to get to Sir Charles's house, moving mainly in Chittagatse, with frequent stops to cut through and check their position in Will's world, closing the windows as soon as they knew where they were. Not with them, but not far behind, came the tabby cat. She had slept since they'd rescued her from the stone-throwing children, and now that she was awake again, she was reluctant to leave them, as if she thought that wherever they were, she was safe. Will was far from sure about that, but he had enough on his mind without the cat, and he ignored her. All the time he was growing more familiar with the knife, more certain in his command of it, but his wound was hurting worse than before, with a deep, unceasing throb, and the bandage Lyra had freshly tied after he woke up was already soaked. He cut a window in the air not far from the white gleaming villa, and they came through to the quiet lane in Headington to work out exactly how to get to the study where Sir Charles had put the alethiometer. There were two floodlights illuminating his garden, and lights were on in the front windows of the house, though not in the study. Only moonlight lit this side, and the study window was dark. The lane ran down through trees to another road at the far end, and it wasn't lighted. It would have been easy for an ordinary burglar to get unobserved into the shrubbery and thus to the garden, except that there was a strong iron fence twice as high as Will, with spikes on the top, running the length of Sir Charles's property. However, it was no barrier to the subtle knife.
Hold this bar while I cut it. Catch it when it falls.
Lyra did as he said, and he cut through four bars altogether, enough for them to pass through without difficulty. Lyra laid them one by one on the grass, and then they were through, and moving among the bushes. Once they had a clear sight of the side of the house, with the creeper-shaded window of the study facing them across the smooth lawn, Will said quietly,
I'm going to cut through into Chittagatse here and leave the window open. I move in Chittagatse to where I think the study is, and then cut back through to this world. Then I'll take the alethiometer out of that cabinet thing, and I'll close that window, and then I'll come back to this one. You stay here in this world and keep watch. As soon as you hear me call you, you come through this window into Chittagatse, and then I'll close it up again, all right?
Yeah,
she whispered.
Both me and Pan will look out.
Her demon was a small, tawny owl, almost invisible in the dappled shadows under the trees. His wide, pale eyes took in every movement. Will stood back and held out the knife, searching, touching the air with the most delicate movements, until after a minute or so he found a point at which he could cut. He did it swiftly, opening a window through into the moonlit land of Chittagatse, and then stood back, estimating how many steps it would take him in that world to reach the study, and memorizing the direction. Then, without a word, he stepped through and vanished. Lyra crouched down nearby. Pantalaimon was perched on a branch above her head, turning this way and that, silent. She could hear traffic from Headington behind her, and the quiet footsteps of someone going along the road at the end of the lane, and even the weightless movement of insects among the twigs and leaves at her feet. A minute went by, and another. Where was Will now? She strained to look through the window of the study, but it was just a dark mullioned square overhung with creeper. Sir Charles had sat inside it on the window seat only that morning, and crossed his legs, and arranged the creases in his trousers. Where was the cabinet in relation to the window? Would Will get inside without disturbing anyone in the house? Lyra could hear her heart beating, too. Then Pantalaimon made a soft noise, and at the same moment a different sound came from the front of the house, to Lyra's left. She couldn't see the front, but she could see a light sweeping across the trees, and she heard a deep crunching sound, the sound of tires on gravel, she guessed. She hadn't heard the car's engine at all. She looked for Pantalaimon, and he was already gliding ahead silently, as far as he could go from her. He turned in the darkness and swooped back to settle on her fist.
Sir Charles is coming back, and there's someone with him.
He took off again, and this time Lyra followed, tiptoeing over the soft earth with the utmost care, crouching down behind the bushes, finally going on hands and knees to look between the leaves of a laurel. The Rolls-Royce stood in front of the house, and the chauffeur was moving around to the passenger side to open the door. Sir Charles stood waiting, smiling, offering his arm to the woman who was getting out. And as she came into view, Lyra felt a blow at her heart, the worst blow since she'd escaped from Bolvanger, because Sir Charles's guest was her mother, Mrs. Coulter. Will stepped carefully across the grass in Chittagatse, counting his paces, holding in his mind as clearly as he could a memory of where the study was, and trying to locate it with reference to the villa, which stood nearby, stucco white and columned in a formal garden with statues and a fountain. And he was aware of how exposed he was in this moon-drenched parkland. When he thought he was in the right spot, he stopped and held out the knife again, feeling forward carefully. These little invisible gaps were anywhere, but not everywhere, or any slash of the knife would open a window. He cut a small opening first, no bigger than his hand, and looked through. Nothing but darkness on the other side, he couldn't see where he was. He closed that one, turned through 90 degrees, and opened another. This time he found fabric in front of him, heavy green velvet, the curtains of the study. But where were they in relation to the cabinet? He had to close that one, too, turn the other way, try again. Time was passing. The third time, he found he could see the whole of the study in the dim light through the open door to the hall. There was the desk, the sofa, the cabinet. He could see a faint gleam along the side of a brass microscope, and there was no one in the room, and the house was silent. It couldn't be better. He carefully estimated the distance, closed that window, stepped forward 4 paces, and held up the knife again. If he was right, he'd be in exactly the right spot to reach through, cut through the glass in the cabinet, take out the alethiometer, and close the window behind him. He cut a window at the right height. The glass of the cabinet door was only a hand's breadth in front of it. He put his face close, looking intently at this shelf and that from top to bottom. The alethiometer wasn't there. At first Will thought he'd got the wrong cabinet. There were 4 of them in the room. He'd counted that morning and memorized where they were, tall square cases made of dark wood, with glass sides and fronts and velvet-covered shelves, made for displaying valuable objects of porcelain or ivory or gold. Could he have simply opened a window in front of the wrong one? But on the top shelf was that bulky instrument with the brass rings. He'd made a point of noticing that. And on the shelf in the middle, where Sir Charles had placed the alethiometer, there was a space. This was the right cabinet, and the alethiometer wasn't there. Will stepped back a moment and took a deep breath. He'd have to go through properly and look around. Opening windows here and there at random would take all night. He closed the window in front of the cabinet, opened another to look at the rest of the room, and when he'd taken careful stock, he closed that one and opened a larger one behind the sofa, through which he could easily get out in a hurry if he needed to. His hand was throbbing brutally by this time, and the bandage was trailing loose. He wound it around as best he could and tucked the end in, and then went through into Sir Charles's house completely and crouched behind the leather sofa, the knife in his right hand, listening carefully. Hearing nothing, he stood up slowly and looked around the room. The door to the hall was half open, and the light that came through was quite enough to see by. The cabinets, the bookshelves, the pictures were all there, as they had been that morning, undisturbed. He stepped out on the silent carpet and looked into each of the cabinets in turn. It wasn't there, nor was it on the desk among the neatly piled books and papers, nor on the mantelpiece among the invitation cards to this opening or that reception, nor on the cushioned window seat, nor on the octagonal table behind the door. He moved back to the desk, intending to try the drawers, but with a heavy expectation of failure. And as he did so, he heard the faint crunch of tires on gravel. It was so quiet that he half thought he was imagining it, but he stood stock still, straining to listen. It stopped. Then he heard the front door open. He went at once to the sofa again and crouched behind it, next to the window that opened onto the moon-silvered grass in Chittagatse. And no sooner had he got there than he heard footsteps in that other world, lightly running over the grass, and looked through to see Lyra racing towards him. He was just in time to wave and put his finger to his lips, and she slowed, realizing that he was aware Sir Charles had returned.
"I haven't got it,"
he whispered when she came up.
"It wasn't there. He's probably got it with him. I'm going to listen and see if he puts it back. Stay here."
"No, it's worse. She's with him. Mrs. Coulter, my mother. I don't know how she got here, but if she sees me, I'm dead, Will. I'm lost. And I know who he is now. I remember where I've seen him before. Will, he's called Lord Boreal. I seen him at Mrs. Coulter's cocktail party when I ran away. And he must have known who I was all the time."
"Shh! Don't stay here if you're going to make a noise."
She mastered herself and swallowed hard and shook her head.
Sorry. I want to stay with you. I want to hear what they say.
Hush now.
Because he could hear voices in the hall. The two of them were close enough to touch, Will in his world, she in Chittagatse, and seeing his trailing bandage, Lyra tapped him on the arm and mimed tying it up again. He held out his hand for her to do it, crouching meanwhile with his head cocked sideways, listening hard. A light came on in the room. He heard Sir Charles speaking to the servant, dismissing him, coming into the study, closing the door.
May I offer you a glass of Tokai?
How kind of you, Carlo. I haven't tasted Tokai for many years.
Have the chair by the fireplace.
There was the faint glug of wine being poured, a tinkle of decanter on glass rim, a murmur of thanks, and then Sir Charles seated himself on the sofa, inches away from Will.
Your good health, Marisa. Now, suppose you tell me what you want.
I want to know where you got the alethiometer.
Why?
Because Lyra had it, and I want to find her.
I can't imagine why you would. She's a repellent brat.
I'll remind you that she's my daughter.
Then she's even more repellent, because she must have resisted your charming influence on purpose. No one could do it by accident.
Where is she?
I'll tell you, I promise. But you must tell me something first.
If I can,
she said in a different tone that Will thought might be a warning. Her voice was intoxicating. Soothing, sweet, musical, and young, too. He longed to know what she looked like, because Lyra had never described her, and the face that went with this voice must be remarkable.
What do you want to know?
What is Azrael up to?
There was a silence then, as if the woman were calculating what to say. Will looked back through the window at Lyra, and saw her face, moonlit and wide-eyed with fear, biting her lip to keep silent and straining to hear, as he was. Finally, Mrs. Coulter said,
"Very well, I'll tell you. Lord Azrael is gathering an army with the purpose of completing the war that was fought in heaven eons ago."
How medieval. However, he seems to have some very modern powers. What has he done to the magnetic pole?
He found a way of blasting open the barrier between our world and others. It caused profound disturbances to the Earth's magnetic field. And that must resonate in this world, too. But how do you know about that? Carlo, I think you should answer some questions of mine. What is this world? And how did you bring me here?
It is one of millions. There are openings between them. But they're not easily found. I know a dozen or so, but the places they open into have shifted. And that must be due to what Azrael's done. It seems that we can now pass directly from this world into our own. And probably into many others, too. When I looked through one of the doorways earlier today, you can imagine how surprised I was to find it opening into our world. And what's more, to find you nearby. Providence, dear lady. The change meant that I could bring you here directly, without the risk of going through Chittagatse.
Chittagatse? What is that?
Previously, all the doorways opened into one world, which was a sort of crossroads. That is the world of Chittagatse. But it's too dangerous to go there at the moment.
Why is it dangerous?
Dangerous for adults. Children can go there freely.
What? I must know about this, Carlo. This is at the heart of everything, this difference between children and adults. It contains the whole mystery of dust. This is why I must find the child. And the witches have a name for her. I nearly had it, so nearly, from a witch in person. But she died too quickly. I must find the child. She has the answer somehow, and I must have it.
And you shall. This instrument will bring her to me, never fear. And once she's given me what I want, you can have her. But tell me about your curious bodyguards, Marisa. I've never seen soldiers like that. Who are they?
Men, that's all, but they've undergone intercision. They have no demons, so they have no fear. And no imagination, and no free will. And they'll fight till they're torn apart.
No demons? Well, that's very interesting. I wonder if I might suggest a little experiment. If you can spare one of them. I'd like to see whether the spectres are interested in them.
Spectres? What are they?
I'll explain later, my dear. They are the reason adults can't go into that world. But if they're no more interested in your bodyguards than they are in children, we might be able to travel in Chittagatse after all. Dust, Children, spectres, demons, intercession. Yes, it might very well work. Have some more wine.
I want to know everything,
she said, over the sound of wine being poured.
And I'll hold you to that. Now, tell me, what are you doing in this world? Is this where you came when we thought you were in Brazil or the Indies?
I found my way here a long time ago. It was too good a secret to reveal even to you, Marisa. I have made myself very comfortable, as you can see. Being part of the Council of State at home made it easy for me to see where the power lay here. As a matter of fact, I became a spy, though I never told my masters all I knew. The security services in this world were preoccupied for years with the Soviet Union. We know it as Muscovy. And although that threat has receded, there are still listening posts and machines trained in that direction. And I'm still in touch with those who run the spies.
Mrs. Coulter sipped her tokai. Her brilliant eyes were fixed unblinkingly on his.
And I heard recently about a profound disturbance in the Earth's magnetic field. The security services are alarmed. Every nation that does research into fundamental physics, what we call experimental theology, is turning to its scientists urgently to discover what's going on, because they know that something is happening, and they suspect it has to do with other worlds. They do have a few clues to this, as a matter of fact. There is some research being done into dust. Oh, yes. They know it here as well. There is a team in this very city working on it. And another thing. There was a man who disappeared 10 or 12 years ago in the north, and the security services think he was in possession of some knowledge they badly need, specifically the location of a doorway between the worlds, such as the one you came through earlier today. The one he found is the only one they know about. You can imagine I haven't told them what I know. When this new disturbance began, they set out to look for this man. And naturally, Marisa, I myself am curious. And I'm keen to add to my knowledge.
Will sat frozen, with his heart thudding so hard he was afraid the adults would hear it. Sir Charles was talking about his own father. But all the time he was conscious of something else in the room, as well as the voices of Sir Charles and the woman. There was a shadow moving across the floor, or that part of it he could see beyond the end of the sofa and past the legs of the little octagonal table. But neither Sir Charles nor the woman was moving. The shadow moved in a quick, darting prowl, and it disturbed Will greatly. The only light in the room was a standard lamp beside the fireplace, so the shadow was clear and definite, but it never stopped long enough for Will to make out what it was. Then two things happened. First, Sir Charles mentioned the alethiometer.
For example, I'm very curious about this instrument. Suppose you tell me how it works.
And he placed the alethiometer on the octagonal table at the end of the sofa. Will could see it clearly. He could almost reach it. The second thing that happened was that the shadow fell still. The creature that was the source of it must have been perched on the back of Mrs. Coulter's chair, because the light streaming over it threw its shadow clearly on the wall. And the moment it stopped, he realized it was the woman's demon, a crouching monkey, turning its head this way and that, searching for something. Will heard an intake of breath from Lyra behind him as she saw it too. He turned silently and whispered,
"Go back to the other window and come through into his garden. Find some stones and throw them at the study so they look away for a moment, and then I can get the alethiometer. Then run back to the other window and wait for me."
She nodded, then turned and ran away silently over the grass. Will turned back.